2012 epidemic is carrying into 2013 here in Alaska.
The first death from whooping cough in more than a decade in the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Dan Bigley describes the bear attack that blinded him 10 years ago.
It would kind of creep up on me and I would swallow little bits of the loss that I endured and start to internalize how my life had changed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Master of Public Administration at the University of Alaska Southeast is building a network of public administrators across Alaska and the Yukon Territory. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
An infant in western Alaska died of whooping cough last month. It is the first recorded death from the disease in the state since 2002. The infant was younger than 2 months, the age when whooping cough vaccinations start. The bacterial infection, which is also known as pertussis, is extremely contagious, and the number of cases in Alaska started increasing dramatically late last year. KCAW's Ann Bryce spoke with Alaska's state epidemiologist, who explains why rates are so high in Alaska.
Since January, over 130 cases of whooping cough, or pertussis, have already been reported in Alaska. State epidemiologist Dr. Joe McLaughlin says pertussis tends to follow a cyclical pattern. Every 2 or 3 years, the Pacific Northwest and the rest of the U.S. will experience an uptick in cases.
So we're only in April, and we're already looking at 131 cases. Now, last year was 2012 was represented a huge uptick in the number of cases compared to previous years. So our total for 2012 was 355. And so the 2012 epidemic is carrying into 2013 here in Alaska.
Compare those numbers to 2011, when there were only 24 cases, and the year before, when there were only 45. He says there are many ways to avoid contracting pertussis. First and foremost, get vaccinated. Number two, wash your hands frequently.
Because, you know, those respiratory secretions can easily be on another person's hand. If you shake their hand, they can be on doorknobs, they can be on tables and chairs, things that we commonly touch. And then if we touch our noses or mouth, they can get into our system that way.
Infants are at the highest risk for hospitalization and death. He also says that over time, immunity to pertussis wanes. So for kids who have had the vaccine as part of their normal list of immunizations, their immunity is high. But doctors have recently seen an increase in pertussis cases in adolescents and adults who have already been vaccinated.
So it could be that in the near future, the CDC and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice may decide to go ahead and recommend another booster shot of Tdap vaccine. We're still waiting to see what CDC recommends on that.
McLaughlin says that immunization coverage rates are low in Alaska and that it's one of the biggest contributors to the high rates of pertussis infection. He says that some people don't get vaccines because they fear risk of serious side effects, but he says the risk is small compared to what could happen if you contract pertussis. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ann Bryce.
Closing arguments were heard today in a Bethel courtroom in the trial of 22 subsistence fishermen accused of fishing for king salmon during closures. The trial began on Monday and included testimony from expert witnesses on both sides. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes was at the trial and joins me now. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Lori.
Give us the background on this case. What happened last summer?
So last summer, biologists were seeing really low numbers with the king salmon run on the Kuskokwim River. And at one point, they closed the river to king salmon for 7 days. And that was a very big deal. It never happened before. The fishermen had experienced windows of closures just a day or two here or a day or two there, but never 7 days all at once. And then they went and closed it an additional 5 days. So it was a total of 12-day closure. And at that point, after the announcement of the second closure, tribal elders around the villages in the region told their fishermen, you need to go fish for your families anyway. And so they did. And dozens were cited. The 22 that we're talking about in this trial right now, they're the ones that decided to say, you know, I'm not pleading guilty, and we're going to see what happens in court.
What case did the defense lawyers make on behalf of the fishermen?
The defense is a pro bono attorney, James Davis Jr. with the Northern Justice Project, and he is going at it from a constitutional rights perspective. This actually happened after October when three fishermen were already found guilty. It went to trial in October initially. Three fishermen were found guilty. At that point, the defense was arguing that the fishermen didn't know about the schedule because it was changing so frequently, and when it was open and when it was closed. And so they were arguing that they weren't exactly sure that it was closed. Fast forward to now, and the defense is arguing that the fishermen have a spiritual connection to the king salmon, so they have a constitutional right to go practice their religious beliefs.
The defense called expert witnesses. What did they bring to this context about the connection that people have with the fish?
Right. The defense brought in three expert witnesses. Two of them testified on Yupik culture and Yupik spirituality. There was a PhD who studied Yupik culture and subsistence particularly. And then an elder, Robert Nick of Nunapacek, talked about, what he knew. And they talked about the spirit of the universe in the traditional Yupik way, and I'm going to try to pronounce the word, Thamua, and that's the spirit of the universe. And basically, it connects the fishermen to the king salmon because basically, if the fishermen do not go and try to fish for the king salmon, this god is not pleased. And if they don't go out, maybe the runs are low because the fishermen are actually not going to fish enough.
Angela, how about the state? Did the state call its own expert witnesses to counter that?
Yeah, one was from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and one was from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And they talked about the low numbers that they were seeing last summer with the king salmon run and why they made the decisions that they did at the time for the closures, which was because they were highly concerned about the low numbers and that they weren't going to have enough for escapement to the tributaries to spawn, and they said that was their priority. And actually, they have to have those escapement numbers before subsistence, which would be next on the list, subsistence hunters or fishermen can go fish.
Angela Denning-Barnes is the news director at KYUK in Bethel. The judge is expected to rule on May 20th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers got their work done in 90 days this year, but they aren't all in favor of it.
Seeing the ups and downs, the vagaries of the process, the 90 days does not serve the public well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Ever since voters decided to shorten the legislative session to 90 days, there's been an expectation that lawmakers will call special sessions to add more time to the clock. This year, they didn't. It was only the second time that's happened since the initiative passed. But even though legislators met the deadline this year, not all of them are convinced it's a good system. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
If you want to find an issue that everyone in the Capitol can disagree upon, regardless of party, it's the length of the legislative session. You might not even find consensus within a single office, as Senator Mike Dunleavy, a MATSU Republican, learned.
How do you guys feel about the length of the session? Should it be longer or shorter?
30 days. I've been 20 with Greg.
We have a diverse staff. One said 30, one said 120, and one said nothing at all.
Dunleavy has his own opinion.
If you're asking me, should it be longer or shorter? I think it should be shorter, to be honest with you. I think the committee meetings, we should probably hold them throughout the year, throughout the summer, spring, fall, and condense the session even more and just hear bills on the floor.
The 90-day session came about in 2006, when voters narrowly passed an initiative to cut down the amount of time lawmakers spend in Juneau by a month. The idea was that it would force the legislature to save money, enable people with families and outside jobs to run for office, and get work done faster. There isn't evidence that the initiative has succeeded in the first two things, but it's definitely put the legislature on hyperdrive. Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Wasilla Republican, is okay with that.
You had to get up early in the morning. You had to work late in the evening. Definitely had to work on weekends, but 90 days is enough.
As a freshman legislator, Gaddis says she's had to cram to get caught up on all of the policy debates going on in the building. It's been tough, but she thinks that if she can do it, then lawmakers who have been there for years should be able to handle it too. For example, she points out that an overhaul of the state's oil tax structure isn't just something the legislature took up in January. It's been going on for years. She says you can also do work in the interim. But even though Gaddis is a fan of the 90-day rule, she was kind of amused by all of the speculation that comes with the prospect of a special session.
So I'm walking up and down the hallways. You guys, you know, are we going to have a special session? Some of the people have been here 20, 30 years. Yeah, we're going to have a special session. I said, well, for how long? Some said 10, some said 20, some said 30. I even had kind of miniature bets in regards to it. Clearly, even the folks who'd been here forever were unable to determine what it is.
Because the legislature has gone into special session more often than not, a lot of legislators from both sides of the aisle have come to a different conclusion than Gaddis. They think that the 90-day limit just isn't working. In 2011, Senator Gary Stevens, a Republican from Kodiak, introduced a bill that would allow for a 90-day session 1 year and then a 120-day session the next. While the bill died in the House, it passed in the Senate with bipartisan support. And the handful of senators who opposed it? Well, they were a mix of liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans. Senator Johnny Ellis, an Anchorage Democrat who has held office since the 1980s, was among those who supported that bill.
My perspective as a longtime serving legislator and seeing the ups and downs, the vagaries of the process, the 90 days does not serve the public well.
Ellis has a lot of issues with the shorter session. It means less time for constituents and more power for the governor's office. Smaller issues that are still important are more likely to be tossed by the wayside. Ellis also says that shrinking the session allows and may even encourage bad process, like limiting time for public testimony and holding committee hearings and floor votes long past midnight.
Things were rammed through. That deserved more time and attention.
But even though he has a lot of problems with the shorter session, and even though he's not alone in that, Ellis doesn't see much will to override the voter initiative. He thinks it'll take a few more years before voters or lawmakers will want to reconsider how long politicians should be in Juneau. For now, at least, the 90-day session looks like it's here to stay. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Climate change could significantly impact the amount of snow that hits the ground and sticks, KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Climate change in Alaska is likely to bring warm temperatures over the next 50 to 100 years. With the heat wave, patterns of precipitation are also likely to change. Stephanie McAfee is a researcher at the Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning, or SNAP. She gathered more than 30 years' worth of climate data from weather stations across the state. Using five different well-known climate models, she came up with different scenarios to explain potential effects on both snowfall and snow accumulation in the future.
The fact that we can do this for multiple models and multiple scenarios is actually one really key benefit to this data set, is that we can look at the diversity of potential futures and see how much difference there is from model to model.
McAfee used models that ranged in severity of predicted climate change effects in Alaska. One of the more aggressive models could mean big changes for Southeast.
Southeast might, as early as the 2040s, start looking a lot more like some place like Washington, where there's very little snow along the coast on any sort of regular basis, but up in the mountains, quite frequently, quite a lot of snow.
McAfee says the same model predicts significant changes in the middle of winter for the Southwest region and Alaska's west coast.
As early as the 2040s in some places, and certainly by the 2090s, large portions of this region are going to be receiving almost exclusively rain, including Anchorage, and even suggesting that as far north as Nome and Kotzebue, a significant proportion of the precipitation could be coming as rain.
North of the Brooks Range, McAfee says models show temperatures will stay cold enough that precipitation will fall predominantly as snow. But the same region could also see more rain-on-snow events during the spring and fall shoulder seasons. McAfee's data are now available through the SNAP website for use among members of the research community. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
An impulse of sympathy by a Sitka couple in Boston has gone viral on the internet as a symbol of people pulling together in the face of violent tragedy. Monday, after the bombs exploded at the Boston Marathon, police stopped the race. Those who could not finish didn't know if their families waiting at the finish were okay. Laura Wellington was one such runner. She was sitting in tears when a woman put a space blanket around her and a man who had finished the race gave her his medal. Later, she reached out through Facebook and was soon in touch with Brent Cunningham of Sitka, who had finished the race, and his wife, Karen. He told the story Monday to APRN member station KCAW.
I mean, we're with a gal and who's crying. She didn't finish the race. And I just feel so much compassion. I'm embarrassed to tell you this, but I mean, I don't want any attention for it, but it was so moving. I just gave her my medal, my race medal. Because I finished and got my medal, and she didn't finish, and she deserved a medal. And so I just gave her my medal because I had to. It was like, I cannot not give it to you. You deserve it. And she just started bawling.
Brent Cunningham works for a teen ministry, Alaska Young Life.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership and business industries across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
A new book out this month tells the incredible story of bear attack survivor Dan Bigley. In Beyond the Bear, Bigley and co-author Deborah McKinney recount the horrific mauling 10 years ago near the Russian River, which blinded Dan and changed his life forever. Dan and a friend were fishing on the Russian River. Returning to their car at the parking lot, they encountered an angry brown bear who huffed at them, hair raised on end. Dan says they slowly backed away and decided to take a longer way back to their car.
I got to a point to where we felt pretty good about the situation again. We were kind of talking about how crazy that encounter was and how she seemed really pissed off for some reason. And all of a sudden, we see the bushes in front of us shaking. And it didn't seem good. We felt like maybe we had been cut off by the same sow. And so we turned around and started heading back towards the trailhead. And in less than 10 steps, she just darted around the corner in front of us at full speed, you know, like a missile, and in moments was on us. And Maya, my dog, you know, was first, and she sort of jumps off the trail, and then John, and so then me, and so I jump off the trail. But unfortunately, you know, I was the closest thing to the shaking bushes behind us, which only in hindsight did we realize must have been her cubs. And so she pulls me out of the bushes, and the mauling, you know, she drug me off into the woods, and the mauling just kind of went on then in waves, phases. And ultimately, after, you know, several, well, we're not exactly sure how long it went on, but what seems to have been, you know, several minutes, she finally came back to me, had flipped me over at some point in the mauling while I was unconscious, and closes her jaws around my face. And that was pretty much when, you know, I checked out. And in coming back to, it was clear I wasn't going to be able to get out of the woods in my own strength, so I just saved every ounce of energy I had to put towards living and staying alive. And it would be 2 hours before the EMTs arrived, and almost over 4 hours before we'd make it to a hospital.
Beyond knowing that your condition was life-threatening when you came to, did you have a sense of how bad your facial injuries really were?
I knew they were really, really bad, but no. I was basically placed into a medically induced coma immediately upon arriving in the hospital, and so it would be weeks before I would really start to hear more information about, you know, the extent of the damages, and even, believe it or not, even over a week and a half before I would even find out that I was blind. So initially, upon coming out of a coma, I just presumed that my head had been very badly damaged and my head was wrapped up. And so it was quite a shock to start to, you know, hear some of the information. And in fact, initially, there was a sign on my door that said, you know, this patient does not know he is blind. Please don't say anything.
How important was Lee Hagmeier, another bear attack survivor from Juneau, to your recovery?
Well, I mean, I can't express how important it was. At a time where I was filled with fear and had absolutely no idea what life would have in store for me, couldn't look beyond the end of the living beyond the end of the day, at a time where I couldn't sit up in bed, I couldn't talk. You know, I was really just out of a coma and just trying to endure everything I was going through on an hourly basis. And I had no idea what a life as a blind person could be like, and it terrified me. You know, I felt like I would spend the rest of my life alone, in that, you know, there's no way that I could live a full life, and that I would, you know, most likely live in an institution and, you know, wouldn't have love in my life. You know, in comes Lee Hagmeier into my hospital room, and he tells me, you know, that in probably a way that only he could have, as the first person to be blind, completely blinded by a bear and live to tell about it, that, Dan, you know, there's still a lot worth living for. There's still a lot of life. There's still a lot to live for. And then went on to tell me about his adventures and his travels and his sea kayaking and backpacking and doing all the things that I very much love to do. It moved me, and it gave me and my family, you know, the most valuable resource we could ask for in that moment, which was the resource of hope.
In your long recovery, did you have a moment of acceptance of your disability, or did that happen over time?
It really did happen over time, sort of little bits and pieces. I think it would have been too much to try to take it on all at once. Perhaps one of the most vivid experiences that comes to mind is a day when I was back visiting Amber and visiting Alaska. Just over a year later, and it was late fall. I think it might have been around Thanksgiving time, and the first snowflakes of the season started to fall on Anchorage. And as somebody who was an avid telemark backcountry skier, you know, that was really my identity and my life's biggest passion prior to the bear. It really hit me, just a deep sense of loss, because I knew that before the bear, I would be grabbing my skis and grabbing a pack and my dog, and we would have been heading out to the backcountry to find glaciers and snowfields that I, you know, to go ski the season's first snow. And the excitement was still there. Like, I had this visceral sort of reaction, you know, of sort of like a classic conditioned response of the snowflakes falling and my adrenaline starts going because I knew what that meant. And then realizing that that wasn't my life anymore, that I moved on and or I had to move on. And so, you know, I definitely teared up and cried. And fortunately, I had Amber there with me to support me through that. And it kind of came up in little bits like that. That's just one example of many where it would kind of creep up on me and I would swallow little bits of the loss that I endured and start to internalize how my life had changed.
The book has incredible detail and is a very compelling, riveting read. Did the telling of it, especially so much detail, bring emotions you hadn't dealt with, sort of a PTSD of sorts or a post-traumatic stress?
You know, there definitely was some of that, particularly in you know, some of the initial writing and rewriting and reading and rewriting parts of it. And interestingly, you know, just kind of as a side note, those always seem to come up more in the rereadings and the readings more so than the writing, which I thought was an interesting thing to reflect on. But I would say almost more poignant than the trauma symptoms that came up initially was more an emotional processing of what had happened and really getting to a place of acceptance and understanding and just kind of dealing with the magnitude and the scope of all the things that happened and not even necessarily just the bad things. Like the first time that I was pushed outside again after the bear in a wheelchair into the yard of the hospital and remembering the feeling that I got when I couldn't talk at the time, but I had this whiteboard that I could write on to communicate with my friends and family. And I heard the very, very oh-so-familiar song of a black-capped chickadee on a branch and the joy, that feeling, the sunshine on my face and hearing that so familiar little tiny bird on the branch next to me brought to me and writing down to Amber, you know, that's a black-capped chickadee, you know, excited that I could still bird as a blind person. I could still recognize that friend in the forest. It was very cathartic, and definitely, you know, reliving some of those experiences was very emotional.
Dan Bigley is co-author of Beyond the Bear with former Anchorage Daily News reporter Deborah McKinney. He lives in Anchorage with his wife, Amber, and two young children. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Bryce in Sitka, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.